Today's episode of the Film Stage Roundtable is brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. For your free 30-day trial of Mubi, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Roundtable, the spin-off podcast from filmstage.com. This is our bi-weekly movie discussion podcast where we talk about things related to film culture, but we don't actually do a full review. We have had many full reviews, so if you're looking for that, go out into the past and find one of them. Today, we have a number of delicious discussion topics to go over, and to help with that, we have Bill Graham.
Woo!
And Michael Snydell.
Hello. For a second there, I thought we were doing a food podcast that I just came about.
I literally just ate dinner, so I may be serving up a buffet of food-related imagery and metaphors, which is, you know, about par for the course anyway. The main course. Today, we have topics that are related to a film that's not coming out this weekend, but next weekend. So that's weird. But what could we really say about Guardians of the Galaxy? Like, what other anthropomorphic forest rodent would you want to see in a Marvel film? I would have to say, like, a possum, probably.
Put him in space!
Don't people love Squirrel Girl or whatever? I feel like I've heard that from...
But she's, like, she's just a human girl with aspects of a squirrel. I'm saying, like, Rocket Raccoon is a full-on raccoon.
Sure.
So if I could get, like, Parsec Possum, I think that I would be cool with that.
Parsec possum.
Yeah.
Are you going to tell the layman what the hell that means?
A parsec is a like measure of distance in space, and a possum is a North American marsupial rodent that has a long bear tail and gray fur.
You're a jackass.
I mean, there's no... As far as I know...
I thought you meant that was a character that existed already.
No, I want to have Marvel create that character.
Okay.
Because I think that they need to have a possum in addition to a raccoon.
Sure. Damn.
Okay, off to a great start. Let me remind everyone, you can find us on Twitter at Film Stage Show, Facebook, search for The Film Stage Show. You can email us podcast@thefilmstage.com. And of course, you can find us on iTunes, look for The Film Stage and The Film Stage Show, and give us a comment and a rating because we love those. They are awesome. And we've actually been getting some recently, so that's been weird. I feel like I can't be passive aggressive about it for like at least another 2 months. Because people
not
are actually
happy.
Doing it. No. Definitely not. So, we are brought to you today by Mubi. Mubi is a streaming online cinema. Unlike any other, Mubi has curators that actually choose films that they deem worthy, and they introduce one a day. That film sticks around for 30 days before it disappears, so there's a constantly rotating selection of 30 films for you to see. You can download these films to your iPod, iPad, iPhone, or any other mobile streaming device. And you can also use the Mubi Roku app, which is sort of new, a couple months old, but some people still don't know about it. It's fantastic. Mubi gives you lots of ways to watch and lots of great things to watch. So if you would like to sample what Mubi's got for you, all you have to do is go to mubi.com/filmstage, and we will give you a 30-day trial on us. So again, that address is mubi.com/filmstage for your free trial of the finest curated movie cinema on the web. That is Mubi. Still ain't got an official tagline. All right. Is everybody ready? Is everybody prepared to get into our first topic today?
Which one is it?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. We didn't really talk about this beforehand. So the first topic for today, as I said, all of our topics are connected to a film that is coming out not this week, but next week, and that, as far as I could tell, no one is excited for, and that is King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. This finds Guy Ritchie.
I am excited.
That is
His last
bizarre.
Movie was Man from U.N.C.L.E. and was really good.
Meh. One of the 17 people in the world who saw that. Anyway,
and they all like it, except Guy Bill. Ritchie,
Guy Ritchie is what you call a contemporary director. Not just in that he is a currently living human being who directs movies, but that most of his first movies were all about modern times. And yet he has gotten a sideline of going back in time in order to be able to create some compelling cinema. That includes not only Man from U.N.C.L.E., but his Sherlock Holmes films, and now he is doing King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. So we wanted to say, what other contemporary directors would you like to see directing a period piece? That is Back in Time from the Back to the Future soundtrack. It's funny to think that when that song was created, he was saying, is this the 50s or is it 1999? And that was supposed to be the past and the future. But now it's just all the past. The 90s could technically be a period film now. Wrap your goddamn minds around that. So let's get into it. Michael Snydell, you had suggested this topic.
Sure.
So I expect you to blow our goddamn minds with your selection. So who is a contemporary director that you would like to see ply his wares back in the day?
Well, you know, like, there were a few people who came to mind immediately, and it's kind of surprising. You know, the very, like, notion of period film is pretty broad and wide-ranging in the sense that there are a lot of directors who you don't even realize have done period films. But I started thinking then about contemporary directors whose sensibilities would, like, particularly be challenged when placed into different time periods. And I started thinking about Yorgos Lanthimos, who most recently put out The Lobster last year, and Dogtooth, and Alps, which I have not seen, but I don't believe is a period film. But I started thinking about Yorgos Lanthimos and how he treats human behavior as just kind of this anthropological study and this, you know, a test of how far he can push, a person's tolerance for oddity. And I just watched Barry Lyndon and was feeling and I'm kind of obsessed with that time period at the moment. So I thought Yorgos Lanthimos and a 17th century costume drama sounded like a great combination.
That would be fairly incredible. I cannot deny that. If only because I'm probably incorrect about this, but usually a period piece doesn't espouse too much, like, raw misanthropy.
Sure.
They use it as an excuse to, like, be classy and dramatic, but very rarely, like, just lay into people. And I feel like Yorgos Lanthimos would just wreck that in the best way possible.
Sure. Like Barry Lyndon is about an extremely terrible person, but it also does have, you know, that air of dignity. And I want to see Yorgos just, like, wreck any sense of decorum by just, you know, debasing any possible social standards.
Good God. All right. That is a that's a killer. That's a killer choice. So good on ya. Let's see what Bill Graham can do.
All right. Well, I got to follow that up.
Pause.
That's right. Let me look up the names real quick just to make sure I get it right. But I kind of chose the same route as Mike and chose something that's someone that would be challenged and particularly moving into a non-modern kind of sensibility is something that I think would be really interesting and would allow these two directors to kind of really go back to their roots in a lot of ways. And that would be the Wachowskis. If you remember The Matrix, and who doesn't, that brilliant little film, and what that film had going for it was not a lot of colors, not a lot of color palettes going on. It was a very kind of atonal film. It kind of harkened back. And I think part of that was because of the aura or the kind of mentality of The Matrix itself, how it was all kind of similar looking and things like that when they were actually in The Matrix, right? But I think even that kind of gritty realism that they brought to the reality when they're outside of The Matrix, whether it's the clothing, and you can see it's kind of in tatters, it's kind of being piecemealed and put together. I just love their just visual sensibilities. And I think they would really bring something special to a medium that doesn't really support it, visual flourishes as much. I hate to bring up Zack Snyder's 300, but I can't. You can't bring up a filmmaker going back and kind of bringing his modern sensibility to a Swords and Sandals kind of epic without mentioning Snyder. I think to a lesser extent, you could mention Tarsum and his whatever the hell that movie was. Oh, Jesus, I can't even remember it right now. With Henry Cavill, that was just
Immortals.
Oh my god, yeah.
It was two and a half hours movie. Of just
this is a pretty movie.
It is a beautiful visually like wondrous film, but my god, that film couldn't have a script to save itself. And it is a drudge to like work through. But I mean, just think about like some of the best images in that film, particularly the scene with the Minotaur and, all of that stuff. I think he just really went gung-ho and went crazy on it. And you can see shades of he loves the horror kind of imagery. And so, you know, you can see shades of The Cell in there and stuff like that. He really just kind of went with the horror aspect of that time period. But I think the Wachowskis in particular would definitely have a interesting time with that time period. And I can only imagine what kind of storylines they could come up with. And I think, like I said, I think kind of bringing it back, reining them back in visually and trying to have them kind of play in a certain color palette that isn't Speed Racer, that isn't, Cloud Atlas, that isn't Jupiter Ascending, mm-hmm. where they just go bananas and they really crank up the volume on everything. I think if they kind of go back to their roots a little bit with the story of Bound and stuff like that, I think they can really make something interesting. So
I got bad news. I don't think they're ever going back. I feel
they're
one of those people who it strikes me like they're never going to do it again.
They keep cranking.
They keep cranking. Yeah, they've gone hard. I do wonder. I mean, Cloud Atlas, you got some period details in there, right?
Sure.
Did they do that one? Because I know that they split up directing duties with Tom Tykwer. So I wasn't sure if maybe he did the period one or not.
It's Tom Tykwer. Tykwer.
Yes, I believe they
did. So they co-wrote and co-directed it. Yes. But, I mean, like, let's be honest. They adapted a novel that was, like, 800 pages long and was split narrative to begin with. So, you know, there's a lot of things. I think they could really bring an interesting modern sensibility, you know, considering the fact that, you know, they transitioned and, you know, now they're known as Lana and Lily Wachowski. You know, I think they could really bring an interesting sensibility to like a Swords and Sandals epic that maybe played with gender and stuff like that, because they've been interested in that stuff forever. Ever since they got in, I mean, even Bound from the outset is interested in kind of playing with gender stereotypes. And then The Matrix, you know, I don't know if y'all read that or heard about that, but, you know, like one of the characters, Switch, was supposed to change genders when she moved from inside the Matrix to outside of the Matrix.
Yes.
And, I wasn't aware of that. Huh.
Yeah,
you know,
I heard about
like.
That.
Yeah, Warner Brothers was like, nah, can we pass?
Here's a greater question. How far, like, so you keep saying, like, Sword and Sandals. I don't usually think of that as a period piece. Am I alone in that?
What do you mean?
I don't know, like, I keep, whenever I think of a period piece,
like, do you not think of Spartacus? Do you not think of Gladiator? Do you not think of 300? Do you not think of those films as Sword and Sandals?
I think it's
they definitely
sandals,
have a lot
but
of
not period. I know that sounds weird, but I like for me a period piece is like, oh, it takes place like I would think like the 1600s are as far back as you can go before it stops being like a period piece.
Then what is it? What does it become?
I don't know. That's an excellent question, Michael. And I've never interrogated that concept before. Until I heard Bill say period piece and then like, oh, we could do like a 300 Sword and Sandals type of thing. Because when I hear Sword and Sandals, and this will kind of lead into our next thing. First of all, I think of like legends, like things that didn't happen in a fantastical sort of place. Because like while 300 is based off of an actual historical event, like they've got.
It's kind of apocrypha.
Like rhinos or something. Like, yeah, it's heightened in a way. Now,
yeah, they got
Gladiator.
Elephants.
Obviously isn't heightened or anything. I don't know. I've never really thought about it. But now that I'm thinking about it, it's kind of blowing my mind.
I mean, those are period pieces.
I guess.
Yeah,
they're set when people literally fucking killed each other with swords, dude. Like, when was the last time that's happened?
I don't know. Probably some guy on a bus in Canada not long ago. I'm pretty sure someone in Baltimore killed someone with a sword like last year. But no, so
yeah, but they didn't fight each other with a sword, right?
That's so, just because the other guy didn't have a sword. But yeah,
exactly.
I know what you mean. It doesn't make any sense to me either, but it's weird because I seem to separate historical epics and period pieces in my mind. So like, I agree with you that you are correct and I don't even understand my own issue.
But the thing about like what you're suggesting is period pieces, the basic identity of a period piece is supposed to be that they transport you to that time period, that place, right? So if I saw a car running through the desert in a Sword and Sandals epic, I'd be like, what the fuck is this shit, right?
That's pretty cool.
so that's what I'm kind of saying is a period piece is supposed to reflect the time period. Now, some of them, like Immortals, like some of these other films, are so high fantasy that they don't quite reach that way because we can't understand. Like, wait, I don't know if that's like period. I can't tell.
For me, a period piece like revels in the details of the culture and society. And so like when you say like 300, it's a little off.
Bit.
Yeah, I mean it does, but at the same time it's so And this is the line you have to walk when you've got like a director like of modern sensibilities directing in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does become like a question of like, is this a quote unquote period piece, or is this just like a crazy action film that happens to be set in the past?
Sure, sure.
You know, it's funny.
I think the one other thing that's kind of interesting in the sense of at least swords and sandals epics that maybe is what you're thinking of a little bit, Brian, is that like those especially like not only do they harken back to like myth or legend, but they like are very much about like back to basics, like deconstruction of narrative. Mm-hmm. And like it becomes like that's not to say that like a 17th century adaptation or, you know, a Jane Austen adaptation or anything like that isn't, you know, dissecting the times as well. But I think there's something specifically about sword and sandals epics that like bring you back to literally like theory of storytelling, like you know, like reconfiguring like the Campbell's hero's journey, like mythology is less than like specific mythology, but like something more granular and like elemental.
Yeah, and I mean it in my mind, for whatever reason, the period piece label is so amorphous and yet so restricted that like even something like The Witch in my mind doesn't count as like a period tale, even though it very clearly is, because it fits literally every single qualification that I came up for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, okay, how about something like Everybody Wants Some or 20th Century Women?
Yeah, those strike me as period pieces.
Okay.
I'm not saying you guys are wrong. I've literally said you are correct and I am wrong. I'm just now interrogating my own weird prejudice about what the hell a period piece is. And I will tell you, Wikipedia is not helpful. It's because I looked it up. I was like, I wonder if there's a thing, you know, that distinguishes an epic or something. And it's no. Just a work set in an earlier time period. So technically, literally any movie that's not set in the future.
I like how this conversation is literally just going to end on a cliff. Like, there's nowhere to go with it.
Well, I can I can pull us back from the cliff. I have thought of a few directors that I would like to see do a period film. But the problem is that some of them sort of have, and this will actually bring us to that question of what counts as like a period thing. Because one of my directors that I really wanted to see do it was Darren Aronofsky. Now, mm-hmm. in The Fountain, mm-hmm. he has a third of that movie set during like the 1500s, where like the
conquistadors,
yeah, the conquistadors
like
are like doing their thing. But
what about Noah too?
Well, I was gonna bring up Noah.
Yeah.
Noah is definitely not, but that's a fantasy setting. Like, that doesn't
be
count.
Careful. Be careful. Careful.
As
the hate mail's gonna flow in.
I am a Catholic. You can't find most of what happens in Noah in the Bible. Okay, so I am very okay with saying Noah is not set in a conceivable historical period. They have okay. attempted to do versions of the Noah story. I'm pretty sure one of them starred that crazy old man who's Angelina Jolie's father.
John Voight,
yeah. I'm pretty sure John Voight played like a Noah in a movie about Noah that was trying to be like period accurate. Noah does not do that. And I love Noah. I'm a fan of the movie Noah. But like, I would love to see Darren Aronofsky like attach his Black Swan sensibility to like 1700s England or something. Like, I think his paranoid, you know, vaguely body horror, you know, even that same concept of like a woman under stress cracking would fit really well in that period. And I think that this, you know, Noah notwithstanding, you know, The Wrestler and Black Swan have a very verite aesthetic that I think would fit well with like the grimy period details of that time. So that's what I was thinking. But again, I wasn't sure if we were going to discount that because he technically already done it in The Fountain. And again, Noah, if you really want to try to make that, I don't accept that. And then I wanted to say David Mamet, who, yes, wrote the script for The Untouchables, but I feel like that's a very modern sounding script, and I'd really like him to try to like dig in to an earlier time period and write his very specific dialogue in like correct period voice.
Like, but then he do The Winslow Boy?
Did he?
Yeah, that's 20th century England. Early 20th century.
And he directed it too. I had no idea. Yeah. Well, thank you for pointing it out to me. No, I'm actually, now I'm going to go look that up.
Get out, Brian. Get out.
I love David Mamet. My other one, and this is just me like going nuts, and I don't even know how to describe how this would look, would be Shane Carruth. But part of me just wants to see another Shane Carruth movie really bad.
Sure.
What was the oof for?
Because my God, that man needs to take less than 10 years to make a movie.
Right.
but I mean, what we keep getting are phenomenal works, but yeah, it makes me sad that he keeps grinding and grinding.
Yeah. But he is sad. He's apparently working on The Modern Ocean, which is in development.
Yeah.
I don't know when it's coming out,
that has like a ridiculous cast too.
Yeah. The cast that was announced was like, what was it? Keanu Reeves and Daniel Radcliffe and
Anne Hathaway.
Yeah. It was
My God.
Nuts. Huh. And
last thing I saw about that was 2015 though. Is that the last thing I could find?
You know who needs to fund his next movie? It's Megan very Hudson. Obvious. Yes.
Yeah.
She needs to just ride her boat up to wherever the hell he is and just be like, hey, here's some money. Go make a movie.
Can I ask, what about him makes you think that he's somewhere that's only accessible by boat?
No, not only accessible, just anywhere accessible by boat. Like a lake, whatever. She can literally just rent a boat and just drive it over to wherever the hell he is. He's in Dallas somewhere. I'm sure he is.
I was about to say, he's like from Texas. I actually think he was born around, he was born in Myrtle Beach and then lived for a while around where I am now, but is firmly in the Texas camp of filmmakers.
Yes. Yeah.
Anyway.
A lot of Upstream Color was actually shot in the Dallas area. So.
Well. So any final, like, did anyone give any thought to someone but decide not to talk about them? Any names we just want to throw out?
Guillermo del Toro was kind of my backup
all the time.
Crimson Peak? Sandals? Sword and Sandals? No.
What? Why are you addicted to Sword and Sandals? We said anything in the past, any period picture.
Because that's what we just rolled with. That was our first two topics. So.
What is happening?
All right. Anyway,
I'm legitimately confused as to what Bill is talking about. Let's move on.
I was thinking about Farhadi. That was one I was thinking about because his films, as much as I love, I universally love his films, but they are so rooted in modern, modern ethos and like following social understandings that are related to the modern day that I would like to see him placed into a foreign context and see what he would gravitate towards in a different era.
Yeah. I had, much like David Mamet, I had a bunch that I was like, ooh, I'd love to see that. And then remembered that they did. So, Michael Haneke, I was like, oh man, what would he do? And then I remembered that he did The White Ribbon, which I loved. So, wow. I already have my answer. Indeed. All right. Well, let's move on to our next topic. This one also related to King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. Because why not? This particular topic involves what other legends we would like to see committed to the screen.
Thank you.
out strolling one very hot summer's day, when I thought I'd lay myself down to rest in a big field of tall grass. I lay there in the sun.
All right, so we have The Legend of King Arthur coming to the screen once again, and we wanted to either A, give light to some other legends that we think could be well served to have a cinematic representation, or perhaps repitch a legend that has already been done but that we believe has not been done well enough. So, we started with Michael last time. Let's go with Bill Graham. Bill Graham, what legend would you like to see committed to the silver screen?
Now, I'll admit a blind spot in kind of Indian and we'll say Middle Eastern film. But I think a full-on adaptation of some kind of take on the Jinni or the Jinn, whatever you want to call it, genie. I think obviously the first one that probably comes to mind is Aladdin, but that is an animated film, and that was more...
Bill, are we forgetting... Kazam with Shaq?
Yeah, no, we're not forgetting that. but moving straight ahead, that was an adaptation of Arabian Nights more than a real kind of story and telling of the legend of kind of the Jinn and the genie. But a couple of years ago in, I guess it came out, yeah, it came out in 2013, there was a book called The Golem and the Jinni, and it was a debut novel, and it was absolutely fantastic. It actually blends historical fiction with kind of elements of fantasy, and it takes place in 19th century New York City, where a golem is basically trying to blend into, I believe it's Jewish, she's in kind of in the New York City, and she's kind of trying to blend in, and all the while a djinn is roaming about and trying to find her as well. It is a really, really fascinating film. It delves really deep into kind of the history of the genie, and even the golem as well. And I think that would be a really, really powerful and fantastic film that could be adapted. It's only 496 pages long, so it's not a really, really long book by any means. They've certainly taken a lot of films like or books like that and shortened them, compressed them into, you know, a 2.5 hour narrative relatively easily. So that's, I mean, it's tough because when we talk about legends, again, obviously, it would be so hard. I think what a lot of films make the mistake of is they take that story, that idea of the djinn, and they basically turn the, you know, the three magical wishes and stuff like that, you know, and there's a metaphor there a lot of times, where, you know, you don't quite get what you want or what you wish for, what you hope for. And I think a lot of filmmakers end up taking that idea and run with it towards the idea of like a horror film. There's been a lot of, you know, when I'm late at night browsing through Netflix, you know, you can see some that pop up that are like, you know, the Horrible Tales of the Djinn, or, you know, The Curse of the Djinn, and all these things that are just horror related. But I think there's a high fantasy kind of tale to be told there, by a really good director that has a unique kind of visual sensibility, and, you know, doesn't mind playing and kind of the legend and making the legends. I think Guillermo, his sensibilities are a little too well suited to that. So I would rather see someone else take on that idea and that task. but he would certainly kind of, if he popped up and started doing something like that, I would definitely be eager to see his take, because whether it's the vampire, whether it's pawn, and you know, creatures like that, he loves kind of building the mythology and the mythos around them. But I think there's certainly a number of other filmmakers that could give that a good crack and probably come up with something really, really interesting. So I think genies. Yeah, I think anything to get away from Aladdin, and any way to get away from I Dream a Genie, the further away we can, and Kazam. I was just about to mention that. any further we can get away from that. And no, Sinbad did not have a genie movie.
I was
sorry
about to say, we can't neglect to say Shazam, starring Sinbad, for anyone who comes from that reality. the book you were talking about, The Golem and the Genie, was by Helene Wecker. And apparently it was a New York Times bestseller, according to the cover of the book. And it does look quite interesting for anyone who's interested in that. Michael Snydell, you profess when we brought this topic up that you knew no legends. So I am very interested to see what you have come up with.
Upon spending 10 seconds with the old Google machine, you know, I found out obviously that's not the case. There's a lot of
Did you Google what is a legend?
No.
He went to Google and then typed in Google, please show me some legends.
.com, yes. there are a lot of films that have been based on legends already. One of my guilty pleasures is actually an old TV movie based on Merlin with Sam Neill. Then I started thinking about urban legends instead. And of course, like, that has been mined a lot for horror, you know, with Bloody Mary becoming the basis of like Candyman or urban legends or anything about a hitchhiker who's just, you know, the least bit askew. But
there's also Urban Legends Final Cut.
Exactly, because you shouldn't even see the first one, but go ahead and see the sequel.
And then there's Urban Legends Bloody Mary.
Anyways, Brian, as I was saying, I started looking up some urban legends, and the one that I got stuck on, and it's one I've heard about and obviously never done any research about, and it is that Walt Disney was cryogenically frozen.
Cryogenically?
Yes, Cairo. Cryo.
Cryo.
All right, cryogenically. Was so cryogenically frozen.
Well, at some point, we'll get this right.
Cryogenic. We good?
Yeah, you got it. You did it.
So I started thinking about this, and, you know, it is absolutely something that's just kind of been distorted and comes from almost, you know, no semblance of evidence. Like, it was kind of TV repairman of all things fanned the flames. Yeah, a former TV repairman who became a president of the California Cryogenics Society actually was the one who fanned the flames and said that Walt Disney wanted to be frozen, and that he apparently had all these questions. And there is one apparently sentence, or I shouldn't say one sentence, but one passage in, you know, official biographies that mentioned that Walt Disney had asked his brother about the possibility of cryogenics, because I was unaware of the circumstances of his passing, but it was caused by lung cancer, because he was smoking up to 3 packs a day, is what I read.
Damn. How does he find the time?
Yeah, that's crazy. So I started thinking about this, and I'm not quite sure about a filmmaker, but I thought about what if Leos Carax, who did Holy Motors and Lovers on the Bridge, and Mavis saying, what if he did a character study about Walt Disney being cryogenically frozen and awoken in 2017 and how he would react? And I guess this has the possibility to get into like really broad, you know, comedy, you know, about anti-Semitism or, you know, like old school sexism, like one of the things that was not uncommon in the time that he was alive was that he did not allow women to be animators at all, right, while he was president or CEO or whatever. So I'm not saying it would be easy, and I think it would be nearly impossible given how Disney treats its creative properties. And we already saw that with, what was it, Saving Mr. Banks? Is that what it was called? The kind of fawning.
I think it was called Saving Mr. Banks.
Yes, yes.
The fawning biopic of the, what was it, Mary Poppins. Yeah, who was really treated Mary just Poppins. Horribly. But yeah, no, I started thinking about this, and I'm not saying it would completely work. And I guess I'm imagining something in the vein of a movie I haven't seen, but I've heard a lot about, which is Paolo Sorrentino's This Must Be the Place, which is like this fictionalized portrait of a like goth person who looks an awful lot like Robert Smith from The Cure. In like modern day, and I started thinking about this, and yeah, I don't know where I'm going with this, but just the idea of Leos Carax working with a bizarre premise like that, I think you could do something really interesting. And if you kind of folded in just these decades and decades of Disney influence and just the way that the company is mutated, or, you know, so it would almost be like a combination of like Holy Motors and Hugo and that level of just kind of influence baked into the general plot. And the more I thought about it, it just sounded delightful. So that's what I would like to see.
It would be interesting to see a movie like that and see how it would wrestle with like what a monolithic giant Disney has become. Like he would have to understand what Star Wars and Marvel are, and then understand that like his company bought them.
Yeah, just the idea of like wrestling with seeing what Disney World became. Like, just there's so many just interesting moving parts of his legacy. Yeah. You know, beyond, you know, just their movies, that I would love to see someone from a different era have to wrestle with that, even beyond like easy social context.
He had like the whole Epcot thing because he wanted it to be like a vision of the future.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's got to come here now and like wrestle with that nonsense, which would be hilarious. Okay, I'm down with that. And that's a great legend to pull from. I am glad that you remembered that you knew some legends.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It's an interesting one to kind of recall out of the blue.
So mine, I want to do a movie version of the, and I am going to massacre this name because I cannot speak Gaelic. The Tán Bathúlann, which is the cattle raid of Cooley. And
still not ringing a bell.
I'm assuming that no one knows what this is. So the Tán is, or the Tone or Tán, I don't know. Gaelic is crazy. So this is a bananas story. It is basically the early Irish version of like the Iliad or the Odyssey. It's like on that level. It's an epic poem. It's insane. And its main character is Cathulain, whose name is literally Cúlainn's hound when translated. And this is why. Because as a young boy, he was walking down the road, you know, in, you know, early modern era Ireland, and or current era, I believe is what it's called. And no one knows what hurling is. Hurling is a game that's played with like a wooden axe shaped stick and a ball that's like a baseball made of granite. And a dog charges at him, and he kills the dog by throwing the ball into the air and hitting it with his stick and driving it down the dog's throat. So the dog dies, but then it turns out that this is a like valuable and fierce guard dog. And so everyone's going to have him killed. And then he's like, you know what? You don't have to have me killed. I'll be your guard dog until you can rear a better guard dog. And he is such a good warrior and a good guard dog that he becomes famous, and he's amazing. And he learns by traveling the world a bunch of different feats of a hero that would allow him to do like great, wonderful things. One of them is called the Hero's Salmon Leap. He also learns something that has been alternately translated as either a warp spasm or torque, because when he gets into a battle frenzy, he literally transforms into an unrecognizable creature monster thing and just wrecks everyone. And that's okay. Just the prologue. So the ultimate story is about the south of Ireland invading the north of Ireland to steal a cow, because it's the best damn cow on the island. And because of a curse from a witch many generations earlier, all of the men of Northern Ireland are out of commission because they are feeling the pangs that a woman would feel while giving birth for like the next 9 days. And so he has to stand alone against the entire armies of Southern Ireland, engaging them in single combat to hold them back, and using a slingshot to kill their greatest heroes while he tries to keep the Southerners from stealing this cow. It's amazing. It's truly, truly goes like batshit crazy. And it's just like everything that you could love. Like it's all of the awesome stuff about Lord of the Rings and like the Legend of Achilles and stuff, but with all the boring stuff taken away. Like It's just constant combat. So if you could get like I don't want to say 300, because I would hate for this to be used in like a Zack Snydery way, but like you could definitely make a goddamn compelling movie out of this if you really stick with the concepts that are involved. Like, you don't have to say like, oh, you know, he could like throw a spear stronger than anyone else. Like, in this movie, he would be able to decimate hundreds of men with a single slingshot sling. And that is in the text. It's there. And it's amazing. And he also, another great thing about this hero, he is never reluctant. He is constantly waiting to prove himself and is just the biggest asshole about it.
Is that our theme this week? Big assholes, apparently. We just want movies about bad people, apparently.
He's not like a bad person. He's just like, he's one of the few, like, he is truly a classical style hero, because he's like, I fucking rule. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm the best. I don't understand why people even bother to fight me, because he's just like certain that he's going to do it. It's amazing. And it's goddamn amazing. I don't even know, like, I can't even begin to explain to you some of the things that happen in this story, because they're insane, because that's just how it is. And you need to like go to the Wikipedia page and read about this. There's a point where a woman who wants revenge on him just constantly turns into other animals to try to stop him, and she just can't do it.
What is your relationship to this a myth. Like, Brian, have you known about this for a long time or been fascinated by it?
I have been. Yeah. My father had a copy of a translation by Thomas Kinsella that was accompanied by ink and brush illustrations by, I can't remember the name of the person, but, you know, it is to the people of Ireland, like I said, you know, their Iliad, their Odyssey, but like no one really knows about it. But I, you know, read it and I was just like floored by it, because you expect something like that to be pretty staid and boring. And then here comes this like 17-year-old Cahulain who literally walks up to like the greatest warrior woman on earth and is like, teach me how to do awesome stuff. And she's like, what could you possibly have to offer me? And he's like, if you teach me how to do this, I'll have sex with you and give you a son, and I'm the best, so you're going to want a baby with me. And she says, fine. Like, it's nuts. It's incredible. Everyone should read it. Get out there and see it. Not see it, because unfortunately no one's made a movie about it yet. But yeah.
Coming to theaters soon.
The reason that the bull is so great, this like cow that they're trying to get, is because it accidentally ate a god. Like, that's the world we're living in. That is
that
what
sounds
this is.
Insane.
So if you want to be able to tell some insane stories with some insane action and just nonsensical things that happen, and if you want to have a hero who has literal superpowers, one of them is turning into a contorted beast of a human that just wrecks everything. He's like a proto-Hulk, but with a sword and a shield.
This sounds like Gilgamesh.
Yeah, it's one of those types of things. It's, you know, every culture had its unkillable hero.
Sure.
And, yeah, this is it. And it has a tragic ending. So, yeah.
That's pretty great.
Yeah, I would honestly, if you can find the translations of the Tan for yourself, there's a newer modern one, and then there's an older one by Thomas Kinsella that's very good.
Can you spell it for the listeners?
Yeah, it's if you look up.
Because I was going to ask you this after, but I realize I should ask right now.
Yeah, we might as well. It's the T A I N. There is an accent over the A, but if you just Google.
Sure.
T-A-I-N, it should work. But the full title is T-A-I-N, again, accent over the A, new word, B, accent over an O, and then C, U with an accent over it, A-I-L-N-G-E. You will not be able to pronounce the character names. Both editions.
There's a badass mural on the wiki page.
Yeah, it's amazing. So check that out. And you should.
So you have not decided on a filmmaker you would like to tackle that?
Oh man, I thought about it for a long time, and I honestly don't know. I almost would love it to be married with, like, I would almost love Darren Aronofsky to do it, because like we were talking about Noah, like he is not afraid of ridiculous stuff. Like sure. If he'll put rock monsters in a film about Noah, I don't even know what he would do with this. So, very possible for that. I would like to stay away from like big budget directors, if that makes sense. Like I would,
sure.
I would do a terrorist act to keep Zack Snyder from being able to make this film.
What about Tarzan Singh? Would you trust him with this one?
You know, honestly, the story is already so insane that I think I would.
All right.
This isn't like a clean narrative that I'm worried he would convolute. I feel like this is in his wheelhouse.
All right, let's get him on the horn.
All right. And then while we're talking to him, we'll see if he can find anyone who can make dinosaurs in space happen for Bill.
Yes!
All right. Well, yeah, that's my thing about the legend of Cahulain and the Tan Bahuli. Cahulain? I don't know. Anyway, that's what it is. Early Irish literature for the win. So let's get out of here. Again, today's episode of the Roundtable is brought to you by Mubi. Mubi, the streaming online cinema where you have 30 days to watch a film before it disappears into the ether. It means you always have 30 great films rotating through your app. For your free 30-day trial of Mubi, all you got to do, everyone's having trouble speaking today, is go to bi.com/filmstage, and you will get to sample MUBI for free for the lifespan of one of its films. Again, that is mubi.com/filmstage. I would also like to point out, even though I tripped up over my MUBI plug, I still had an easier time pronouncing Gaelic than Michael had pronouncing
cryogenics.
Yeah. But you seem like you're on top of it now.
I've only said it 55 times in my head since I fucked
up. You've just been practicing, hoping that you wouldn't have to say it again. All right. Well, that is it for today. The next time we speak to you, we will be reviewing. Oh, God damn it. Guys, are we going to have to review Guardians of the Galaxy?
Of course we are.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, fine. All right, so we'll be reviewing Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. That will be this weekend.
Some points.
What was that?
Right, guys? And Free Fire at some point. Right, guys?
We will somehow find a way
on the record
to make you seeing Free Fire have been worth your time. Maybe we'll just have a review segment, like a separate episode where we each just get to like spout off about a movie, because I still want to do a T2 review and we haven't been able to do that.
What?
So maybe I could do T2 Trainspotting.
Mike, okay.
You could do Free Fire, and Bill, if you see a movie that we haven't had time to see, you could do it, and we could just like have a little sampler dish of an episode.
I'm down with that.
All right, well, okay. we'll try just because Mike has made it very clear how upset he is that he had to see Free Fire. So we'll try that out. All right. So that's it for today.
I know all the listeners are just now waiting to know what I think of Free Fire. Did he like it or not? Who knows?
Yeah, it's a true that is a true question. So Bill Graham, why don't you tell us where you can be found online between now and the next time that we talk?
You can find me on Twitter at CableBFG. You can also find me writing for movies about movies on the film stage and also freshfiction.tv.
All right, Michael Snydell.
You can find me at Twitter at Snydell.
Yeah.
And you can read my writing at Film Stage and Pace Magazine. I'll say more on this week's podcast, but I have an interview coming up I'm pretty excited about.
Ooh.
So look out for that.
You can find me. I'm gonna live tweet a rereading of The Ton so that everyone can hear about all the ridiculous great things that happen in it. That is at Brian J. Rowan. I have a number of interviews happening, but none of them affect any of this, so I won't bring them up again. And you can find me writing on thefilmstage.com and my personal site, dearfilm.net. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us, and as always, tune in next time.